This is the Africa Debrief by Atlas News. Hello and welcome to the Africa Debrief by Atlas News, where we take an in-depth look at the region's top stories and analyze and explain them to you. In this episode, we'll delve into the recent attack on a 30-year-old man in Vosman, South Africa. The man was abducted, his hands were amputated, and he was left for dead. This brutal case raises troubling questions about the continued practice of Muti attacks in the country. Muti, also known as Umuti, refers to traditional medicine in some parts of South Africa. However, it can also hold a darker meaning, signifying witchcraft and the use of body parts in rituals. Traditionally, Muti killings involved the belief that using body parts from strong or healthy individuals could bring power or protection. Anthropologist Harriet Ngubane explains that within a specific context of Southern African traditional medicine, some practitioners might have historically viewed ritual killings as ethically permissible in certain situations. However, with ritual killings now illegal, a disturbing trend of attacks that stop short of murder but involve amputations has emerged. This isn't an isolated incident. A 2001 academic study suggests that nearly 2,500 people were caught with body parts in their possession, highlighting the concerning prevalence of this practice. The Mpumalanga province, where the recent attack occurred, seems to be a particular hotspot. In 2021, a shocking case involved an infant who had her hand amputated at Bernice Samuel Hospital while admitted for diarrhea. Though officially a Muti motive wasn't investigated, the timing and circumstances raise serious questions. The recent attack on the man in Vosman strongly suggests a connection to Muti practices. Police are investigating the case, but so far there haven't been any arrests. It's important to note that this is a complex issue. Muti holds cultural and traditional significance for some South Africans. However, the violence associated with it is horrific and illegal. Law enforcement needs to prioritize cracking down on these barbaric acts. There's also a need for open conversation and education to address the root causes that perpetuate these beliefs in modern South Africa. Next, we'll discuss a recent seizure of elephant tusks in Mozambique. Mozambique's Criminal Investigation Service, CERNIC, and Tax Authority, AT, intercepted a shipping container holding a staggering 651 pieces of elephant tusks headed for Dubai. The discovery raises serious concerns about the ongoing illegal trade in elephant ivory. The tusks were cleverly hidden within a container filled with corn, highlighting the increasingly sophisticated tactics used by traffickers. Experts believe the ivory likely originated not just from Mozambique, but potentially from neighboring countries as well, suggesting a network of organized crime is at play. Now, Mozambique is no stranger to the ivory trade. Wildlife crime experts have labeled it a safe haven for criminal organizations from China and Vietnam. Several factors contribute to this: widespread corruption, inadequate protection of government stockpiles of ivory, poor cooperation between different agencies, and weak penalties for those caught trafficking. This case also underscores the complex web of the illegal ivory trade. Dubai often serves as a transit point, making it difficult to track down the masterminds behind poaching and trafficking operations in Africa. The United Arab Emirates claims they have no domestic ivory market, and any confiscated ivory is simply passing through. While this may be true, it ultimately fuels the demand in other countries where the trade is still very much alive. The international community has taken steps to address this issue. The Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, CITES, regulates trade in tens of thousands of species, including elephants. However, enforcing these regulations remains a challenge. The recent seizure in Mozambique is a positive development, but it also highlights the ongoing struggle to dismantle these criminal networks. Stronger international cooperation, stricter penalties for traffickers, and addressing the demand in consumer countries are all crucial steps needed to protect these magnificent creatures. Now, in a concerning development, Malawi's president, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, has declared a state of disaster in 23 out of the country's 28 districts. This drastic measure comes in response to the devastating effects of El Niño, a weather phenomenon causing both drought and flooding cycles. The president estimates that nearly 2 million households face food insecurity due to these extreme weather patterns. He has made a plea for assistance from both national and international organizations to help combat this crisis. El Niño, as defined by the World Health Organization, is a major contributor to global climate fluctuations. It disrupts normal weather patterns, leading to extremes like floods and droughts. These combined events can wreak havoc on agricultural production, causing soil degradation over time. The WHO points to several severe food crises in recent history with links to El Niño. The situation in Malawi is particularly concerning. A recent report by the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs highlights the impact of El Niño on southern Africa. This El Niño event, predicted to last until April 2024, has brought high temperatures and extremely low rainfall to the region for months. Several countries, including Malawi, have experienced the lowest rainfall in at least 40 years. The report further warns of potential water scarcity, food shortages, and disease outbreaks as a result of El Niño. Tragically, Malawi has already seen outbreaks of cholera and red locust infestations since October 2023, likely exacerbated by the changing weather patterns. Malawi's declaration of a state of disaster underscores the severity of this situation. International cooperation and support are crucial to help the country cope with food insecurity and other challenges brought on by El Niño. Next, we delve into the tragic story of Albert Sithole, a young man beaten to death by a mob in Thembisa, South Africa. This incident, though horrific, is far from an isolated one. Mob justice, where communities take the law into their own hands, is a serious problem plaguing many impoverished areas of South Africa. Let's unpack the details and understand the underlying factors that fuel these acts of violence. The death of Albert Sithole, allegedly found in the wrong yard while intoxicated, sparked outrage. The community claims Sithole, known as Maseven, was a serial robber and rapist who terrorized the area. They allege he was carrying stolen goods, justifying their brutal actions. However, police faced a wall of silence from bystanders, hindering any investigation into the truth of these claims. This lack of cooperation highlights a deep distrust in the South African Police Service, SAPS. Thembisa Police Station consistently ranks among the worst performing in the country, with particularly high rape case volumes. When residents feel the authorities are failing to protect them, a desperate sense of self-preservation sets in. This isn't the first time Thembisa has witnessed mob justice. Earlier this year, five men were stoned and set alight on suspicion of robbery, even though no stolen goods were found on them. These incidents reveal a chilling trend: mistaken identities leading to the deaths of innocent people. Reports suggest hundreds of such cases occur annually. The root cause of this problem lies in a potent mix of fear and frustration. Communities with high crime rates feel powerless. The formal justice system seems distant and ineffective, leaving residents vulnerable. In this atmosphere of desperation, mob justice becomes a twisted form of seeking immediate safety, even if it means resorting to brutal violence and sacrificing due process. The solution requires a multi-pronged approach. Strengthening the SAPS is crucial. This involves improved training, increased resources, and a focus on building trust with communities. Additionally, addressing social and economic inequalities that contribute to high crime rates is essential. Providing opportunities and fostering a sense of security can help break the cycle of fear that fuels mob violence. The death of Albert Sithole is a stark reminder of the tragic consequences of mob justice. It's a symptom of a deeper malaise within the South African justice system and society as a whole. Only by addressing the root causes of crime and strengthening the formal justice system Can South Africa truly break free from this cycle of violence? Now we delve into the complex situation unfolding in Southern Africa. The Southern African Development Community, SADC, has made the critical decision to withdraw its military mission, SAMIM, from Mozambique's Cabo Delgado region. This move comes after a 2-year deployment aimed at quelling an insurgency by non-state armed groups, NSAGs. Let's dissect the reasons behind this shift and explore the potential consequences. Mozambique's Foreign Minister, Veronica Macomo, cited financial constraints as a key factor. The insurgency by groups like Ansar al-Sunna, linked to the Islamic State, has caused immense suffering. Thousands of civilians have been displaced, with food security becoming a major concern, especially considering the wider El Niño-related food crisis in southern Africa. While the SADC presence aimed to create a secure and stable environment, the mission faced challenges. The Mozambican Armed Forces, FADM itself, struggles with irregular pay and food supplies, hindering their effectiveness. Furthermore, critics pointed out the limitations of SAMIM's resources, particularly the lack of heavy weaponry and air power, crucial for tackling insurgencies in vast, jungle-like terrains. Despite these challenges, the withdrawal creates new anxieties. A security vacuum is likely to emerge, potentially emboldening the NSAGs and leading to further attacks on vulnerable communities. This could exacerbate the humanitarian crisis and act as a recruitment tool for the insurgents, who often exploit desperation by promising food and security. The SADC is not abandoning its regional security commitments. Instead, it's shifting its focus to the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, where another military mission, SAMIDRC, is already deployed. This move reflects the complex security landscape in Africa, where multiple regions grapple with insurgencies and require international assistance. The situation in the DRC is equally concerning. Rebel groups like M23 pose a significant threat, and previous peacekeeping efforts by the East African Community and the United Nations have fallen short. The SADC hopes to fill this gap, but replicating success hinges on addressing the resource limitations that hampered the Mozambique mission. Bolstering air power and ensuring proper equipment and supplies for troops will be critical. The coming months will be crucial for both Mozambique and the DRC. Mozambique faces the daunting task of securing its territory with a potentially weakened military presence. The SADC's success in the DRC depends on learning from its experiences in Mozambique and addressing the shortcomings in its military deployments. This is a situation demanding close attention as regional stability hangs in the balance. Next, despite public declarations for peace talks, both Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame continue to exchange harsh words. Tshisekedi accuses Rwanda of backing the M23 rebel group, while Kagame points fingers at the Congolese government for supporting the FDLR, a militia responsible for the Rwandan genocide. These accusations aren't new. The roots of this conflict run deep. Rwanda has a long history of involvement in the DRC, including the brutal wars of the 1990s. The presence of the FDLR, a group comprised of perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide, on Congolese soil, is a major point of contention for Rwanda. The DRC, on the other hand, feels threatened by Rwandan support for the M23 rebels. This tit-for-tat blame game isn't helping matters. Previous peace talks, the Luanda and Nairobi processes, established roadmaps for de-escalation and disarmament, but ultimately fell apart. The recent deployment of regional forces, first the EACRF and now the SADC, hasn't yielded significant progress either. With the UN mission in the DRC, MINUSCO, also on its way out, the situation seems precarious. There are over 120 armed groups in the eastern DRC, making lasting peace a monumental challenge. A glimmer of hope emerged with a recent meeting between high-level officials from both nations, paving the way for a potential summit between Tshisekedi and Kagame. However, no date has been set, and the hostile rhetoric continues. this conflict has had devastating consequences. Renewed fighting since January has displaced tens of thousands and threatens the major city of Goma. A peaceful resolution is urgently needed. Whether the upcoming talks will bring about a breakthrough remains to be seen. We'll continue to monitor the situation and bring you updates. Next, Kenya's healthcare system is facing a major disruption as a nationwide doctors' strike enters its second week. The Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists, and Dentists Union, KMPDU, began their strike on March 14th, demanding better working conditions, a signed collective bargaining agreement, CBA, proper placement for medical interns, and improved medical insurance coverage. Talks between the government and the KMPDU have reached a stalemate. The government refuses to negotiate further until the strike ends, while the KMPDU insists on continuing the strike until their demands are met. The consequences for Kenyans seeking medical care are becoming increasingly dire. Many public hospitals have halted some services entirely, while others operate with significantly reduced capacity. Emergency services have slowed down, and some patients have reported waiting over a week to see a doctor. The burden has fallen on nurses, registrars, and interns, but they are often stretched thin and may not be equipped to handle all cases. Many Kenyans are being turned away from public hospitals altogether and directed to private facilities, which can be prohibitively expensive for a large portion of the population. This has created a difficult situation for many unable to receive care at public hospitals due to the strike and unable to afford the high costs of private health care. The remaining medical staff at public hospitals are facing burnout due to the overwhelming number of patients they are forced to attend to. With some forced to turn to home remedies or simply hope their health issues won't worsen, the situation is critical. The KMPDU blames the government's stubbornness for the crisis, fearing a rise in preventable deaths. There is no clear end in sight to the strike, leaving the Kenyan healthcare system in a state of disarray, and many Kenyans struggling to access essential medical care. Now, a month-long dispute between Kenya and Uganda over oil import licenses has finally been resolved. This disagreement stemmed from Uganda's desire to import oil directly, bypassing Kenyan middlemen. At the heart of the issue was Uganda's frustration with what they perceived as inflated oil prices due to Kenyan involvement. They aimed to handle their own imports through the Uganda National Oil Corporation, UNOC, using Kenya's pipeline company, KPC, infrastructure. Kenya had been negotiating a deal to grant UNOC local operating licenses, but ultimately denied them, citing unfulfilled requirements. This denial escalated the situation, leading Uganda to take the unprecedented step of suing Kenya before the East African Court of Justice. The dispute was significant because Kenya handles roughly 90% of Uganda's oil imports, making them a critical customer for Kenya's transportation sector. While Uganda did explore alternative routes through Tanzania, Kenya's superior infrastructure made a resolution with Kenya still desirable. Fortunately, a solution has been reached. Kenya will finally issue the licenses, allowing UNOC to operate locally and utilize KPC's infrastructure. This ensures Kenya maintains revenue from transportation, though local Kenyan oil companies will see a decrease in business. The official license issuance is expected to take place next month, in April. This agreement marks a positive step for regional cooperation in East Africa. Finally, Kenyan authorities have begun the difficult process of returning the bodies of victims from the horrific Good News International Church cult to their families. This religious group, led by self-proclaimed pastor Paul Nthenge Mackenzie, convinced many followers to starve themselves to death in the belief they would meet Christ. Mackenzie was arrested in April 2023 after the discovery of mass graves containing the remains of 429 individuals on his property. The extreme decomposition of the bodies made DNA identification a lengthy and arduous task. The first remains were handed over to families on March 26th in Malindi, Kenya. Understandably, many family members expressed grief and dismay at the condition of their loved one's remains. Authorities are charging McKenzie with a multitude of offenses, including murder, terrorism, assault, and child torture. 95 other individuals initially considered victims now face charges as well. Investigators discovered that some of these individuals had children who died within the cult and were buried in the mass graves. Others provided false identities or failed to account for their deceased children. Allegations also suggest some actively participated in enforcing the starvation regimen and preventing escape attempts. McKenzie maintains his innocence, claiming he cannot be responsible for deaths that occurred after the church's closure in 2019. His trial, along with his associates, is set to begin on April 23rd. This tragedy serves as a stark reminder of the dangers of cult manipulation. The Kenyan government faces the ongoing challenge of supporting grieving families while bringing those responsible to justice.